Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today, on Memorial Day, we will speak with veterans of the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, and the war in Afghanistan. We'll begin with Dr. Philip Butler, a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts, and spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. Then we will speak with Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated combat vet who served in the Gulf War and is now a supporter of Ron Paul, who is by far the most popular Republican candidate with veterans and serving military. We will discuss why the author of Warrior's Rage supports a candidate who is against intervention and is often described as anti-war, and why Colonel McGregor opposes Mitt Romney's military and foreign policies. Then finally, we will speak with Jacob George, who served 3 tours in Afghanistan and recently took part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded in Iraq and Afghanistan. We will discuss his concerns about America's military of the future that will rely more and more on drones and special operations. And joining us now is Dr. Philip Butler, who is a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merits, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today serves as a trustee for the Big Sur Land Trust, a docent at Point Lobos State Reserve, and is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ed.
And on this Memorial Day, of course, there's some indications of some reflection above and beyond the kind of knee-jerk jingoism and patriotism that we often see that seems very sentimental in many ways, never questioning war, never questioning sacrifice. And it's, I should think, given what happened in Vietnam and Afghanistan, isn't it becoming more and more difficult for the collective kind of consciousness of the country to be so blind as to, you know, that these wars of late really have not solved any problems. They've just created enormous debts, deaths, and, you know, disapproval of the United States. I mean, I'm struggling to think of what we can say. What would you say, Phil, to a veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I'm pleased to see that there are some people on active duty, and I know some veterans who have come home that have awakened to the notion that all of these interventions that we engage ourselves in all over the world is not helping the people in our country, our citizens of the United States, nor is it really helping the people in other countries. These two wars that we've been engaged in, and of course there's more than just Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, as you well know, there's Yemen and all sorts of other places that our military, CIA, and quasi-military are engaged in around the world. It makes me so frustrated and angry to see how long all this stuff is going on. Americans don't have much of a sense of history, but we have just an absolutely incredible history of wars and interventions around the world. Just there's a website I'd like for listeners to have. There's a professor at the Evergreen State College up in Washington. The man's name is Zoltan, Zoltan Grossman, Grossman. And Professor Grossman has made a lifelong study of U.S. interventions around the world. And the last time I went on his website and looked at the number, we had 142 military interventions since Wounded Knee through 2008. So that's just, you know, just stuff happening basically in the 20th century. 142 military interventions in other countries, and that's just the stuff that we've been up to. And I guess this last couple of episodes by George Bush has so affected our economy here that maybe some Americans are finally waking up to the fact that we have hungry and starving people. We have 40,000 people with no health care. We have deteriorating infrastructure. Our educational systems are going to pot. And hello, where's all the money going?
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's 40 million.
40 million. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, 40 million.
40 million without health insurance.
Yeah, thank you.
Actually, I think it's closer to 50, frankly. So tell me, though, when you talk about all the interventions that we've been involved in, we would be involved in more interventions had John McCain become president of the United States. He's been calling for a war with Iran and calling for the U.S. to intervene in Syria. And you served, you spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam, longer than, of course, the John McCain. It feels like to me that he never recovered from his defeat in 2008. And he's been sort of waging a war, not just trying to get America into war, but he's been waging a war against President Obama and his legitimacy as a leader. How does that strike you?
Yeah, I think I'd have to agree with that. I've known John a long time, of course. I know him back at the Naval Academy and in the Navy. And like you say, he joined up with us POWs. I think John was there for 5.5 years. And so he did quite a long time. And then he came home and got his Vietnam, service highly advertised and marketed to get elected to be a senator. A lot of people might think that John McCain was the only guy that had bad treatment in North Vietnam, but in fact, over 90% of us were tortured at least once over there. We used to say the Vietnamese were very democratic about how they treated American POWs. But anyway, yeah, he's an incredible knothead and hawk. He, as an individual, as a person, he has really bad temper. You know, he can fly off the handle and get angry at a moment's notice. So, thankfully, he decided to select an idiot to be his running mate for vice president. And I think probably that's what defeated him. Otherwise, he might have beaten Obama if he had had anybody sensible as his vice presidential nominee.
Well, the other presidential nominee now, of course, on the Republican ticket is Mitt Romney. And what I find extraordinary about Mitt Romney is that he's been running for president for over 10 years and has never bothered to tutor himself about foreign policy or military policy and would outsource it all to the neoconservatives, the very people that brought us the Iraq War.
Just a few weeks ago, Romney made the statement that the Soviet Union was our number one enemy. He hadn't picked up on the fact that the Soviet Union is defunct after like 1989. So for over 20 years, it's been Russia, not Soviet Union, and he had absolutely no clue about the status of our relations with Russia. And like you just said, he has no clue about foreign policy at all.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who spent 8 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merits, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. And he today is a trustee of the Big Sur Land Trust and a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. On this Memorial Day, Phil Butler, is there any sense then of the debate getting wider in terms of the military about what the purpose and the use of American military power should be? The New York Times is covering on Memorial Day, has an article about how there's a spirited debate going on inside West Point over the recent policies, going back to George W. Bush's announcement at West Point of his doctrine of intervening. The impression I get is that the soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan pretty much have had to accept the fact that it was really all that blood and treasure and sacrifice wasn't for very much at all. In fact, that's what these general officers are saying at West Point.
Well, I certainly hope that they come to that conclusion, to the proper conclusion. It didn't really happen with people coming home from Vietnam. There were a couple of years after I came home from Vietnam in 1973. I had high hopes that the United States had finally learned, but I still hear many of my fellow Vietnam veterans saying, that was a war we should have won, and the only reason we didn't win it was because we were stopped by the politicians and we weren't allowed to pursue it to the fullest state. I mean, you know, that right-wing rhetoric, notwithstanding the fact that we killed 2 million Vietnamese people, and notwithstanding the fact that they have their own country and government right now, and they seem to be doing just fine without our help.
And indeed, you can make the argument that as long as we're fighting the Vietnamese, we would lose, and the leading first world country, the dominant power in the world, could not break the will of a third world country. But the minute we stopped fighting them, they immediately turned around and wanted our economic help.
So I think the same thing's true with Afghanistan. It's almost a copy, you know, of the Vietnam example. It's sort of the same thing. You know, we could pour troops into Afghanistan until we were blue in the face. We could get 500,000 troops in Afghanistan, and we'd never really defeat Afghanistan, because what's Afghanistan? It's a whole bunch of tribes of people whose culture are so dramatically different from ours that we wouldn't have a clue.
Well, but I guess the point being that maybe we should find other ways to employ our power and influence as opposed to at the tip of the bayonet, you know, that maybe we should be thinking more of if humanitarian aid and nation building are the challenges of the future. Maybe we should revitalize the Peace Corps.
Well, you know, when Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, which, of course, was a very prescient and thing for him to say, if he were alive today, he'd be astounded, I think, at how much his prediction came true. I mean, just for example, if you go on the internet and take a look at what we actually have, if you tally up all in just within the 50 United States, if you tally up all the major and minor military bases, all the small depots, all the CIA and FBI black site facilities where they're listening in, you know, to conversations and stuff, if you did that throughout the 50 United States, you come up with a pretty big number, and the number is 6,000. We have 6,000 military bases and installations of various types inside the United States. And we have approximately 1,000 U.S. military bases and facilities in other countries in the world, along with 325,000 military and civilian personnel. Now, that's a hell of a structure. And we've got a government, a politic, and an economy that's structured to exist with that. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to turn that around. And I do believe it's going to take a couple of generations, even if we were to get started on it right now.
So just sort of pulling back into a broader context, and Dr. Phil Butler, do you think that the American Republic will survive the American Empire?
I don't know, but I think the American Empire is going to crash economically, financially, and then Americans will have to take a look at restoring the Republic. Americans have always been good at, you know, being quick and moving, quick on their feet and moving, and they're good with innovation and business and so forth. So at some point down the line, there's hope, but boy, we sure are at a deficit right now. If you just look at where we are with education and healthcare compared to other countries in the world, we rank way, way down the line. We've really drop back, notwithstanding the fact that we've lost our moral authority over people in the rest of the world with all the torture and black sites and stuff that we've done during the Bush administration, and some things are continuing today under the Obama administration.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Phil Butler, do you see a change in our military doctrine with General Petraeus, who led, of course, the counterinsurgency idea, which eventually it looks like Vice President Biden was able to thwart that. You know, Petraeus is basically saying we'd be in Afghanistan for generations. Like, he couldn't give an exit date. And clearly, it's just untenable. And NATO and the U.S. are pulling out, albeit they're going to leave some troops behind. But the impression I get is that now that Petraeus is at the CIA, some people say, well, you know, that shows you how the militarization of our intelligence. But then other people say, well, it actually is the opposite. It's the military getting more like the CIA with a smaller footprint and more specialized, you know, special forces units. And that's where the emphasis is on robotics, drones, and special forces. Do you see that? Because I imagine the military-industrial complex will want to keep selling expensive weapons, so they wouldn't be too happy with that kind of a downsized force.
I think that that sort of a militarization is made to order, because I think it suits the military-industrial complex and it anesthetizes the American public if they don't see young people being slaughtered and killed, and there's no draft, and there's just volunteers and people sitting at Nellis Air Force Base that can push buttons and kill people in other countries in the world with drones. I mean, it's just sort of a made-to-order new militarization. But, you know, the United States is going to come a day when other countries that are irritated with us and don't like us, and they have this technology too. For example, China and probably other countries in the world, Russia and other countries, may say, fine, you want to do this? We can play this game too. So we really, in my opinion, need to pull in our horns. We need to tend to our knitting here at home. We need to rebuild our society and our culture here in the United States and retake a look at our morality and become a beacon of light, positive beacon of light to people in other countries in the world like maybe at some time in the past. We were, and that's the best way, in my opinion, that we can continue to defend ourselves against terrorism or any other sorts of military authorities from other countries.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Philip Butler.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Philip Butler, who was a 1961 graduate of the United States Naval Academy and a former light attack carrier pilot. In 1965, he was shot down over North Vietnam, where he spent 8 years as a prisoner of war. He's a highly decorated combat veteran who was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merits, 2 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts. He completed his naval career in 1981 as a professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and today serves as a trustee for the Big Sur Land Trust, a docent at Point Lobos State Reserve, and he is a peace and justice activist with Veterans for Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Colonel McGregor, who is campaigning for Ron Paul.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of 4 books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage. McGregor was commissioned in the U.S. Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. He is a supporter of Ron Paul and a spokesperson for veterans groups that are organizing marches and demonstrations on behalf of Republican candidate for president Ron Paul. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Thank you.
And it would seem a bit of a paradox that a military man would be supporting Ron Paul, who, if you watched the Republican primaries debates, of which there were a lot, he was sort of treated as an eccentric, but he was the only person that was actually talking seriously about the extent to which the American empire as threatening the Republic, or how much whether the Republic will survive the empire, and calling for, you know, a real look into the wars that we've been engaged in and why we get into them and why we should get out of them, in effect. And so that's my first puzzlement. I know it's a long question, but why a military man being with somebody who's considered a peacenik?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard peacenik attached to Ron Paul, but then again, maybe nobody decided to say that to my face.
Well, I could probably find a more pejorative word that somebody like a Newt Gingrich threw at him, but the general feeling was that he would be a disaster for American national security. That was the attitude that the Republican candidates had.
Well, the Republican Party, frankly speaking, bears very resemblance to the Republican Party of 35, 40, 50 years ago. It has become very much like the Democratic Party in many of its attitudes. And most important, there isn't a great deal of daylight between some of the people you mentioned who've been running for president and their views on foreign and defense policy and, let's say, Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon. And I think that's part of the reason that I and so many others with experience in the military, specifically people who've been in action, regarded the statements about the United States, its position in the world, and its real interests seem disconnected from reality. That's the best way I can think of to describe the statements by, you know, Newt Gingrich on foreign and defense policy, or Santorum, or Romney. They don't seem to be aware that the long and difficult period of debt-financed consumption as the basis for economic growth is about over, that we are on the verge of a very serious fiscal crisis that's going to hurl us into something I think is going to look like the Great Depression. And I think that Ron Paul's grasp of economic reality, frankly, is one of the reasons that many of us listen to him, but also because we served in these places, Afghanistan, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, the Emirates. We've been in these places. We've seen the people that are there. We understand what is attainable and what isn't. And quite frankly, the goals that were set by the neocons under the Bush administration were entirely unrealistic. And we've squandered trillions of dollars and thousands of lives and blood and treasure on what was always a fool's errand. And so to listen to people who want us to go forward and engage in yet more fool's errands is something we weren't willing to do.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary to think that the candidate who got the Republican nomination has been running for president for 10 years and has not bothered to develop a military doctrine or a foreign policy doctrine and is outsourcing it all to the neoconservatives, the same people who brought us the Iraq War. That I find extraordinary, that he literally would have a kind of vice president in charge of the military and vice president in charge of foreign policy as though he were corporate CEO. I mean, I find that disturbing, not just the neocons, but the fact that he doesn't seem to have developed any thoughts or policies regarding the military and foreign policy.
Well, first of all, I think you're right, although I would apply much of the same description when it comes to foreign and defense policy to President Obama. I think that Obama probably had stronger feelings about what he didn't want to do, but he inevitably capitulated to effectively the same kinds of people surrounding him that surrounded George Bush, with the same connections to the neocons, to Wall Street, and so forth. So I don't think that's all that surprising. Unfortunately, I don't think there's much interest in the American electorate at this point in what I would call real substance. I know that sounds harsh, but things aren't bad enough to induce people to demand accountability and fundamentally change, a fundamental change in direction. I think that's the
largest issue. I think that everything that Ron Paul has been saying and advocating will be vindicated in the years ahead, particularly on the foreign and defense policy side, where I think we'll simply run out of money and we'll withdraw from most of the places that are being depicted as vital to us, which in fact are not. So I agree with you. I just don't know that there's a great deal that we can do about it, because I don't think people are very interested. I mean, I talk to lots of Americans, and most Americans want desperately to be patriotic. They want to believe in certain things about their country. And when you tell them that bombing people in remote places is not really a demonstration of American greatness, they have become so accustomed to what I would call remote war without consequences to them personally, they are immediately afflicted with cognitive dissonance. They can't grasp it. They listen to it in the mainstream media day and night, that someone in a remote mountainous region of Yemen has to be killed or the survival of the republic is at stake. It's all nonsense. It's absolutely wrong. But they've been conditioned to accept that, and since they don't connect the dots at this point, they don't understand the trillions that have been lost, and I say trillions, it's not just $1.3 or $1.4 trillion, they don't perceive any damage to us overseas. They don't understand the consequences for the armed forces or the selection system that produces senior officers that are willing fellow travelers for these bad ideas and bad policies. So unfortunately, before we're going to see anything change in the United States in that regard, I think we're going to have to see a much tougher set of conditions domestically, economically.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of four books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage. And he led the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II in the Gulf War, and has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. And in terms of you being a supporter of Ron Paul, polling has indicated that both in among veterans and serving military, Ron Paul is the favorite candidate by a considerable margin. Again, how do you explain that? If in many ways he's talking about that we really have to look at the broader utility of our armed forces and to some extent retreat back to the United States in again using the analogy that the republic is threatened by the empire, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has always been in every nation in the history of Western civilization a connection between a large, powerful, and intrusive federal government at home and a large military presence and activity overseas. That's not news, and Ron Paul is simply warning people that the two are connected, and we can't become healthy here at home until we also deal with the problem overseas. My own view is that the problem overseas, Ian, is going to take care of itself. I mean, the British left India not when the British should have left India, which was many decades earlier, when it was no longer a commercially viable operation to stay, where there was no profit involved, if you will, for the British. They left when they ran out of money and resources. And that happened after two devastating world wars that left Britain in ruins and destroyed its prosperity and national power. We're not as bad off as Britain was at the end of these two world wars, but we are running into very hard financial times. And as a result, I think most of what's happening overseas will be dramatically scaled back. Then the question is, what do you do with what's left over? That's something that we should talk about. But the second part, I think, is very, very important of what you mentioned earlier. And that is that the veterans themselves, they know how money is spent inside the military establishment. People think if you allocate a dollar to defense, you get a dollar's worth of defense out of the dollar. You don't. We have an expression in the Army, nothing's too good for the troops, and nothing is usually what they get. That's meant as black humor, and it is black humor in the sense that people don't understand that you don't get necessarily what you pay for, and trillions disappear into all sorts of people's pockets. They don't necessarily produce viable military power. I think that has a big impact, and again, you know, the recognition that we could occupy most of the world outside of Western civilization and have almost no impact whatsoever except to create and cultivate enormous hostility against us. And that's something that people, again, at home don't understand. You tell the average American, look, we're exporting democracy, and everyone is grateful to us. How would he know the truth? No one bothers to tell him the truth. And, again, the truth isn't very popular. You tell him, no, our interventions have been disasters, self-defeating. And lots of people look at you and think, well, you must not like America, which, of course, is absurd. Because those of us who serve in the military wouldn't serve at all if we didn't fundamentally believe in our country and in this republic. But we know that the whole thing is at risk unnecessarily because of these imprudent overseas adventures.
Well, in terms of the military-industrial complex, it's always been clear that the priority has been the toys and not the boys. And I don't know whether you saw the recent 60 Minutes piece, Colonel McGregor, where two serving pilots in the Air Force went public, risking their careers, to explain that they're blacking out from lack of oxygen in flying the Raptor, which is about $500 million a copy.
Yeah.
And they can't even fly the things to the point where they can be proficient because they're so quirky and expensive. Going back to the Iraq War, which the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewel described as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus led his armies into Germany in 9 AD, the president seemed to do that in many ways for personal reasons. And they never had, it turns out, Colin Powell's revealed this recently, they never had one cabinet meeting to discuss going into Iraq. And it seemed like Cheney did the entire endgame around everybody, including the president. And, you know, I don't want to be too cynical, but let's face it, the only people that profited from the Iraq War were the Halliburtons of this world. The Iraqi people certainly suffered, and the U.S. military servicemen and their families suffered.
Well, there are also a lot of people, so-called contractors, retired four stars, three stars, some in the defense industry, because not all of the defense industry has profited. But those are the people that also profited handsomely, I might add, and so did many politicians because of interests in their districts and constituents that they have that were involved in contracting and profiting from the episode. There's something else, though. I can't resist the opportunity to say this. Van Creefeld was right, but he failed to tell everyone the rest of the story. And the rest of the story is that after the three Roman legions and auxiliaries were destroyed in Germany, Augustus did hold a meeting, had a council, and they made the decision to simply lie about it. And so for decades thereafter, there was really very little appreciation inside the Roman population for the scale of the disaster in Germany, other than the prudent decision was then made not to cross the Rhine anymore, and very few incursions were made. But the truth is that the solution was to lie, and quite frankly, the Romans got away with it. They lied about this terrible defeat, and I'm afraid that we've got a similar situation now. People are just lying about what did or did not happen in Iraq, and it goes on with Afghanistan. And again, the public seems ready at this point to still accept the lie.
So, Colonel McGregor, what do you make about the New York Times on Memorial Day front page story? West Point asks if a war doctrine was worth it, a spirited debate on counterinsurgency and its costs. It's as a former U.S. military man, and obviously you're in touch with serving people as well. It seems to me that there is quite a lot of reflection, to put it mildly, going on within the military about what were these two wars about. I mean, here we are on Veterans Day, you know, thinking about war and the cost of war, and those that made the sacrifices. It's a pretty bitter pill, isn't it, that these wars were completely unnecessary, counterproductive, and we'll be paying for them forever.
Well, keep in mind that the 3- and 4-star generals, some of whom are retired and some of whom are still on active duty, are the people that profited from their contribution to the disaster. There isn't much reflection on their part. And if you, depending upon which news station you turn to, there are lots of them on to tell the American people what a huge success it was and to talk about the bravery and the courage of the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who fought and gave their lives. So the reflection is at relatively low levels, and I think Colonel Gentile, who was mentioned in that up at West Point, is the tip of the proverbial iceberg when you get down to the full colonel level and below. But if you think there are large numbers of ones and two stars, all of whom want to be three and four stars, who are prepared to stand up and discuss any of this honestly and openly, you're very much mistaken. And I don't see any evidence that anyone in the Obama administration wants to touch it. Everyone would prefer just to forget about it and walk away. And that's the problem. We forgot about things at the end of the Vietnam War and walked away. I suspect we'll do the same thing with Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's ill-advised, because we certainly don't want to continue this. But again, there is a group in Washington, political, military, and commercial, that is very interested in these things and will do whatever they can to find ways to justify these types of interventions in the future. And this is what Ron Paul has been talking about. It's what he's running against. It's why he's not going to be nominated. But I do believe that in the long run, he will be vindicated over the next 2-3 years in particular.
But Colonel McGregor, do you think that the military will? I mean, some people have said that Petraeus being at the CIA is not so much about the CIA becoming militarized, but more about the Pentagon becoming more like the CIA, in as much as smaller footprint, which is what happened in Afghanistan initially, more special forces, drones, etc., and not these big standing armies. Is that
well? Remember that you maintain general purpose forces, Army, Navies, Air Forces, as a strategic hedge against the possibility that you may have to fight in a war that you would otherwise avoid. That is the historic American rationale for standing armed forces. That changed in 1991 when the Clinton regime came to power, and you will recall Madeleine Albright, who challenged Colin Powell and said, "You're always talking about this great army, so why can't we use it?" And the left began the process of employing military power in support of whatever cause they saw anywhere in the world that interested them, that could become a laboratory for experimentation to realize their utopian dreams. And we've been on that slope ever since, and the Bush administration did nothing to interrupt it. In fact, the Bush administration turned into an extension of it.
Well, that was the right wing.
I would argue that we've been through 20 years of this. It's just that the last 10 have been particularly expensive and destructive. And I think we're at the end of the period. I do think Americans have had enough. But again, connecting the dots is not easy. There's a book out by this fellow Rasmussen who does polling. He doesn't really tell us anything new, but he points to something that anyone who studied American history understands, that there really hasn't been much movement in the thinking of the American people over the last 200 years about overseas interventions and foreign entanglements. The majority of the American population doesn't want it. It never has. And so to get the American population involved in these things, they've had to be effectively hoodwinked into things, dragged into things, persuaded that something was true that wasn't in most cases. And I think that's what's happened over the last 20 years. I think we're at the end of it because we can't afford it. The real question is, will we ultimately expel this bipartisan elite in Washington from power that pushes these bad policies? And I think there's an opportunity over the next 2 or 3 years because of this very serious fiscal crisis that's headed our way.
Well, just on the notion that the left going back to the Balkans were having utopian fantasies, I think that most of the pressure on the left was largely about humanitarian considerations. It seems that the real damage was done on the right by the neoconservatives, who truly were recklessly utopian.
Well, having been part of it, Ian, I disagree with you, because I was involved in the planning for the intervention in Haiti. And I was on the tail end of the Somali intervention. And then, of course, I was involved in the intervention in Bosnia-Herzegovina and subsequently in the Kosovo bombing campaign. And many of the same actors were present throughout these events and came back to life again and had a big role with Mr. Wolfowitz and his crew in arguing for the dismantling of the Iraqi army, its government, its administration, so the place could be neo-Nazified and turned into some sort of utopia that would eventually become friendly to Israel. So I think all of these people are birds of a feather. One may stand a little to the left of the center, the other to the right, but they're all very similar. And so having served with all of them and seen all of them in action, there isn't much difference. And the humanitarian card is routinely played as justification for all sorts of things. I heard that played on the way into Iraq and then subsequently in Afghanistan. All of these pleas from people like Blair and Clinton that were about humanitarian intervention to save the Muslim Albanians from the evil Serbs. Those things were repeated again shortly after we went into Afghanistan, that justified a large footprint there with the object of transforming this pathetic area of the world, this tragic place, into some sort of utopian liberal democracy. This is not new, but my point is this 20-year period is about over. And the real question is, what do we do next? And what do we do about the people that have been delivering these disasters to us over and over and over again?
Well, and meanwhile, of course, we don't intervene in the Congo, where 5 million people have been butchered. So it's kind
of
selective.
I encourage you to try. But again, I think, you know, I don't think the United States Armed Forces were created to be world policemen for the purpose of transforming other societies, stopping people from killing each other. This sort of thing has been going on for a very long time without us. It's going to go on without us once we leave all of these places. In fact, the lesson of history, which the neocons in particular don't want to learn, is that if you'll get out of the Middle East and North Africa, the lesson of the last 1,000 years is these people aren't going to bother you, but they're going to spend a lot of time fighting with each other.
Well, on that note, Colonel McGregor, I'm afraid we're running out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us here on Veterans Day and for offering your perspective. It's been
well, thank
very
you for inviting me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran, the author of 4 books, the latest of which is Warrior's Rage. He was commissioned into the United States Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point, and served in the Gulf War, leading the U.S. Army's largest tank battle since World War II. McGregor testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. He is a supporter of Ron Paul and is a spokesperson for veterans groups that are organizing marches and demonstrations on behalf of Republican candidate for President Ron Paul. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Jacob George.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Jacob George, who has served 3 tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army and recently took part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded for service in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jacob George.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And on this Memorial Day, Jacob, you, as a veteran, I know you've gone back to Afghanistan after serving there for 3 tours, coming in initially right after the 9/11 and with the first intervention. In terms of reflections, I see a lot of jingoism. I see a lot of I don't see any real deep questioning going on in the media about whether these, particularly these two recent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, were worth the sacrifice, the loss of blood and treasure?
Well, there was a mother at the demonstration in Chicago that I think summed it up best. Her son had committed suicide, and she spoke with us. And basically she said, we need to heal the wounded, honor the dead, and stop the war. Her son had committed suicide largely because of the lack of mental health treatment that he had sought out, attempted suicide multiple times, and still couldn't get the help that he needed. And I think if there's one thing we as a nation need to reflect on this Memorial Day, it's how are we treating our veterans when they come home? Almost 18 veterans commit suicide a day there's a mental health crisis in the U.S. military right now in terms of vets getting treatment, service members getting treatment for mental health and other issues. And if we really want to triumph our national heroes, so to speak, I think taking care of them is the single best thing we can do.
Well, it's a little cynical, isn't it, that all of the we're very quick to go to war and very slow to take care of people once they've been to war. It's almost I recall when some of the soldiers in Afghanistan were complaining to Donald Rumsfeld about the IEDs that were blowing up and their vehicles and how lightly armored they were or not armored at all. And he sort of said, well, you go to war with the army you have. There seems to be a kind of a blasé attitude amongst the authorities about using the boys and girls, but, it's kind of throwing them away after they've used them.
Yeah, and it's there's a lot of speculation around why. If every single vet and family member who deserves benefits was to receive them at this point in time and in the future, it would cost more than the wars themselves. So advocates for this type of thing know that it's unlikely that we're ever going to see what we truly deserve, but it is important to continue to struggle for as much as we can get.
But Jacob George, Halliburton got their money. The contractors have already gotten their money. That's the part of it that burns me, that the money that was spent on that war, they've already cashed in. The money that's owed to you and the other vets, you got to fight for it.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate, and that is the reality. That's the truth of the whole thing. I think it just speaks volumes to why we're there in the first place. The fact that that's happening, what you just said. And I wish it was different. I wish there was things that we could change, but it's kind of grim.
Again, I'm speaking with Jacob George, who served three tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army. He recently took part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded for service in Iraq and Afghanistan. What's your sense of, in terms of fellow veterans, about the future of the U.S. military? There's a growing trend, obviously, in the use of drones that suggests a sort of war made easy, made painless and bloodless, and unless you're on the receiving end of a missile, going into smaller sort of special forces units, more special forces, more black ops, portrayers at the CIA leading that kind of transition, if you will. Do you see a future in which the use of military force will be actually easier than it's been in the past, or will the politicians step up and ask some more questions?
I think that's a really good question, and that is something we need to look at very closely. The special operations community has grown exponentially since September 11th, 2001, for example, the United States Air Force at this point in time doesn't have a single aircraft that is coming to light that has a manned pilot. Almost every single aircraft in development for the U.S. Air Force is remote controlled, and the ground forces are slowly transitioning to special operations forces, from the reports that I've read and some of the transformations that I saw while I was in, it's very likely that the military as we understand it right now is on its way out, and that the military of the future is mostly going to be a special operations force. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the main reasons is exactly what we were talking about earlier, the cost of having a huge military once the war is over. If they could just have a handful of special operations operators, that are training people in the countries that we want to go into to do the dirty work, instead of having soldiers do that and then having to pay for us for the rest of our lives. That's actually a better investment for the Department of Defense.
But what about the military-industrial complex? They like to build extremely complicated and expensive weapon systems like the F-22 Raptor. I don't know whether, Jacob, you saw the 60 Minutes piece recently where the two pilots went public risking their careers as whistleblowers to point out that this aircraft that costs about $500 million a copy, the oxygen supply is not working, and the pilots are blacking out and losing aircraft and losing their lives, and they can't do sufficient training on them. And it's a Cold War weapon of dubious utility. In this transition to special forces, how are the military-industrial complex going to make the kind of money they expect to make?
Well, I think ridiculous projects like that are exactly how they're going to continue to make a lot of money. Special operations community uses very sophisticated weaponry and equipment, and there's a lot of money to be made there, as well as arming the forces that the special operations community is training. And I think with the heightened development of unmanned aircraft, which is the future of the Air Force, there's going to be plenty of opportunity for investment and dubious technology, as you put it.
Going back, you mentioned you came into Afghanistan in the first month after the U.S. Went in there in 2001 following the September 11th attacks. A lot of people have said, including, by the way, candidate Barack Obama and now President Obama, he basically made the argument in the election that George Bush took his eye off the ball and never finished the job in Afghanistan, and went into this disastrous war in Iraq instead, and that's why we've been in trouble ever since. As a veteran, what's your interpretation of what happened and what went wrong?
Well, as much as I don't want to place blame on anyone for this in particular, I will have to say that the Taliban was effectively toppled within 6 months of us being in that country and removed from power. And one of the things I've always questioned about this, and again, I don't have enough of the bigger picture to know this, but why did we stay there longer than that? Unfortunately, I don't think we'll ever really know the answer to that question, but we could have left shortly after that. And still accomplish just almost everything we wanted to accomplish, for the most part. One of the reasons I say that is because it was in the beginning a CIA-led operation. There were CIA operatives on the ground working with special operations forces, which is one of the first times this has happened in a long time. And what that means is there was a very light military footprint, which means we could have easily gotten out of there just as easily as we got in. But unfortunately now, 10 years later, it's not going to be as easy to leave, as you have pointed out.
So is that to say then that our heavy footprint, all the boots on the ground, a Christian army in Muslim lands, is that a part of the problem itself?
Well, I think the inability to be culturally sensitive to a lot of the Muslim cultures in Afghanistan is definitely a huge problem, and a military that does have a predominant Christian presence is something that can look slightly insulting when people are ignorantly, I don't think purposely, burning religious texts. And in Afghanistan, a lot of things travel by word of mouth. People share stories, they talk to each other a lot. That's how a lot of news and information is shared. So when things like this happen, they spread as rumors, and there's simply no way to rebuild our image when stuff like that happens, especially given that we are seen as a predominantly Christian military in a Muslim land.
So, Jacob George, what are you doing today on Memorial Day?
Well, I am for the most part, reflecting on the past year of work, especially the action in Chicago. And I'm in transit. I'm going home to see my family for about a week before I continue training for social justice later this year.
So how do your family and friends feel about you throwing your medals towards the NATO meeting? You mentioned when I talked to you the day that you did it that you tried to hand your medals over to an official with NATO, but because of a security, you couldn't even get near the place. So you and the other vets symbolically threw your medals towards where the NATO meeting was taking place in Chicago, somewhat reminiscent of the Vietnam War days.
My friends are very, very encouraging. My friends really like this work and encourage me to do it. My family, on the other hand, I haven't told them that I did that yet. And when I get home, I'm kind of going to probe the situation and see how they feel about it before I really break the news to them, because they're not in total support of things like that. And just hanging out with them and having a good time is more important to me than trying to talk politics.
Well, I guess, that goes back to my original question to you, Jacob George, isn't that the strangest thing that at least what I find about Memorial Day is that it is devoid of politics. It's just that we unconditionally support the troops and what they did. And you'd think that actually it might be a better occasion to think about why we did these things and whether or not they serve the national interest and what maybe we should figure out something else to do and a different way to deal with national security issues.
In an ideal world, that would be amazing. I wish I could open this dialogue up with my parents and we could sit down at the table and have a serious critical analysis of U.S. foreign policy and the past 10 years of war. But unfortunately, that isn't available. That's not something I can do. And maybe over time, I've seen them change a lot over the past 2 years. And maybe as this thing unrolls in the future, we'll get closer to that dialogue. But as for now, as you say, it is a blind day for barbecuing.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today on Memorial Day, Jacob George.
Well, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Jacob George, who served 3 tours in Afghanistan with the United States Army and recently took part in demonstrations against NATO in Chicago, where he and other veterans returned medals that they had been awarded for service in Iraq and Afghanistan. This has been Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm